You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What can America learn from Flint's water disaster? That's the question at the heart of a national water infrastructure conference that's beginning today in Flint. Among the speakers on this first day, retired Brigadier General Mike McDaniel. He directs the city's Fast Start program. And General McDaniel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. Always great to talk with you.
I remember very clearly when you and I talked just a little over a year ago, and you had agreed to direct the Fast Start program, and that goal was to replace more than 20,000 aging lead and galvanized service lines in Flint. So as we talk today, how many of those old lines have been replaced?
Well, so far we've replaced about 800 service lines in 2016, and that 2016 contract year is still ongoing. And we've dug up about 930 homes. Unfortunately, about 160 were copper to copper. So we just replaced the valve there and the shutoff valve and the junction box and then filled it back up again. I bring that up because it emphasizes the need for us to have better records of where the service lines are located and what their composition is.
Let's talk some more about those roadblocks that you've had to deal with, both expected and unexpected.
We learned a lot in 2016, our first year of doing this. I'd say our first concern, unexpected, was the quality of the city records. We knew that they were incomplete. They turned out to be about 63% accurate. The city has two sets of records, one sort of based on a plat book, which gives us the location of the shutoff valve itself, which is where we have to dig down. And those were determined by going so many feet from the nearest cross street for each home. So there's a tendency there to be wildly inaccurate as you're sort of using one of those wheels 50, 70 years ago or pacing it off trying to get the right location for the service line by finding that shutoff valve. And then secondly was the composition of the service lines themselves. Many times it would, on that little plat book, it would have a C or an L, like for copper or lead, but we'd have both there and we wouldn't know until we actually dug there. We also had a system of index cards, which the city keeps for each address with the same information on it, and those are in the process of being digitized. The city has been digitizing those since the 1990s, but any from before that period of time, we've had to go back and sort of digitize those ourselves and then sort of harmonize like an accountant between the two different sets of records to see where we have the issues. That was the first issue that we had, but it's been a major one trying to determine exactly where we should start, because we're looking for areas of the city that have the greatest density of lead service lines as the place to start. And then we couple that information with any information that we can find about the residents themselves. And of course, we're not looking for HIPAA or any sort of personal identifying information. We're looking for, based on census data from 2014, we're looking for senior citizens, we're looking for children under six, because we're told that those are the individuals are the most susceptible to lead poisoning. The second big problem we sort of learned as we went was that the lead lines were not necessarily the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario was where you had a lead line to that junction box, to the shutoff valve that I've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, on the homeowner's side, you have a galvanized line, because there's sort of a chemical reaction, you know, between those two metals, and the lead makes the galvanized lines corrode even faster. So inside that galvanized line is a surface area that is increased up to 10 times what it was originally, with all this rust buildup and then the lead adhering itself to that rust buildup. As well as that, water is coming through those holes, those lines, in only a trickle. That turned out to be the worst case scenario, and we had to focus then not just on where we have lead service lines, but where we have lead to galvanized lines. So if we have either of those, lead or galvanized, we're replacing them, and that became a problem because we had to identify them, and then again, that makes our subset of lines to be replaced versus the total lines in the city much greater, since we have to say we're going to replace all lead or galvanized lines going into residences in the city.
You had said last fall you were hoping that more than 1,000 service lines would be targeted in this contract spell, so you haven't quite hit that goal, but do you think the pace of replacement is going to pick up now that spring is here?
Yes, absolutely. For 2017, Cynthia, we just received bids back on our RFP, and what we envision is replacing 6,000 service lines within the city between April and end of November. We divided the city up into 10 zones of 600 homes each for this next phase, and then contractors could bid on each of those phases independently so that we would have both more contractors working and that they are required to work simultaneously. So as a result, we expect that we'll be able to do the 6,000 service lines replaced in 2017.
How long do you think it's going to take before you can say the job is done, those old aging lead and galvanized lines are gone?
Right. So there's a couple of issues there. The first is, how do we define when we are done? There has to be at least one of those major phase lines, those major accomplishments has to be when we replaced all the lead and galvanized lines, as you suggest. One of the reasons that we were doing this is because early on, you know, when we talked a year ago, it was very clear that there was no trust from the city residents in the system itself. By the system, I mean the water distribution system. Replacing those service lines has helped to regain the trust of the residents, as well as to assure cleaner, potable water for the residents to use. I can't say that that will be the end of all the issues, because some of it has to be where the residents trust the system to give them clean, potable water. And there may be that more is needed, but I will say that I think this will take care of a huge amount of the problem. This is the one place where we have found that there is lead, and the lead is contributing to the quality of the water in the individual homes. Every expert and scientist, whether it's from a university, whether it's from other outside entities, whether it's from state or federal government, agrees that if we replace the lead and galvanized service lines, we will greatly increase the quality of the water. And that's what we're striving to do. One of the issues, though, as you suggest, is sometimes it doesn't feel like it's really a fast start when we say it's going to take another 3 years to replace all the service lines. We will have done, by the time we're done with this phase, around 825 service lines, and then we're going to start right in with the 6,000. If we do that for 3 years and we replace, we think, around 19,000 lines, we will have addressed the problem. That does take us 3 years, and that may not seem fast, but in comparison with replacements by other cities such as Lansing, they did not have a crisis, of course, but they had an orderly program for changing out their service lines. It took them over 10 years to do 14,000 lines. So if we accomplish the replacement of 19,000 service lines in 3 more years or 4 years total, that will be a very ambitious program, but we think it's what's needed.
General, at the same time, do you feel like you're kind of right in the middle of the logistics of what it's going to take to get those lines out of the ground and the frustration of the people in Flint who wonder if they will ever be able to trust their water?
Yes, no question. There's a tension there at all times between realizing we have to depend upon the science, wait for the orthophosphate lead coating to work in circumstances where you don't have a lead or a galvanized pipe, and replace the ones that you do, to also either upgrade or restructure other parts of the water system and explain to the residents why, you know, it takes 4 or 5 years and millions of dollars to achieve a problem which has been slowly continuing, and that the infrastructure has been slowly crumbling for as many as 80 years. We have some pipes in distribution and transmission pipes that are 80 years old. That's a little bit longer than you want your cast iron pipes to get. But the city of Flint is not at a place yet where it can have a maintenance schedule and just replace those as more economically sound cities where they've got a program in place to do that maintenance on a regular basis based upon what they know they can receive from federal funding. So we're not there yet. And that's a hard, hard lesson for these citizens, because there's so much that we have to do, and they've already suffered so much. They've been living in fear. They've been living in doubt since 2015, at least. But it is not fixed yet, and it's going to take at least 3 or 4 years to do so.
And is the money there to get you across the finish line, or will Flint have to keep going back and trying to shake money out of somebody to get this done?
The money's not there in the sense that we do not have sufficient money yet committed from state and federal governments to do so. We have enough money to do 2017. We have enough money to do most of 2018, but we don't have enough to complete 2018 or 2019 for service line replacements. We certainly have commitments from the governor and his staff that they will continue to work with us, and they have been doing that, but we don't yet have a commitment for the funds, no.
As you speak to the Water Infrastructure Conference today, what should other regions of the country learn from what you're doing in Flint?
A number of things. First, I hope with my remarks, they're going to learn from the problems that we had so that they assure that they've got an active maintenance program, that they're looking at all the city-owned critical infrastructure, and whether it's, you know, bridges or pipelines or transmission systems, and saying we have to maintain this now because it costs way too much to get it right side up again when it collapses. And then secondly, I hope that they're thinking about ways in which they can sort of build resiliency into their system. One of the things that we have found is that the many different utilities are not placed where they should be placed, you know, when they do them in the ground. You know, we have sewer and water lines that are on top of each other. We have gas and electrical lines that are too close to the other lines. It's like you've got to have that planning on the front end and that effective regulation of any sort of repairs that are done to systems, and keeping those records is just so important. It's that little stuff that city government needs to do to stave off these sort of problems. And then I think the other thing is talking about what do you need to do to assure that this doesn't happen? You know, it's sort of a comparison of a city like Lansing, perhaps, where the Board of Water and Light had a program to replace this on a regular basis and were able to do so out of internal funds, out of Hyde, whereas the city of Flint did not have a program in place. And when everything collapsed, we had to seek the funds from the state and federal governments. So I think there are broad issues in terms of planning, in terms of response, and then in terms of infrastructure resiliency that I hope that other cities take away from this.
Retired Brigadier General Michael McDaniel, who directs Flint's Fast Start program, speaking on this first day of the National Water Infrastructure Conference in Flint. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.